Case 22-33033 and 22-3367, Cincinnati Development III LLC versus Cincinnati Terrace Plaza LLC et al. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Turer for the appellants.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Adam Turer on behalf of Cincinnati Terrace Plaza LLC, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. I had three, and then I had six.
Five.
Set on five. All right.
Throughout the course of this argument, my client, Cincinnati Terrace Plaza LLC, will be referred to as the seller. The plaintiff, cross appellant, and appellee will be referred to as the first buyer. So Cincinnati Development III LLC is the first buyer. This is a case of two sophisticated business entities entering into a contract ultimately for the purchase of real estate. It was a membership interest purchase agreement, a very common commercial real estate transaction, whereby the first buyer would purchase the LLC membership interest and thus acquire the single asset of real estate that the LLC owned. We had a bench trial in the district court, and Judge Barrett entered two separate partial opinions and orders, which were then merged into one final order. That is what this appeal is from. The first partial order was on the issue of liability and included separate findings of fact and conclusions of law, and the second partial order was on the issue of damages, and that also included separate findings of fact and conclusions of law. Seller has appealed from the final order on two grounds. One, on the liability issue, because we believe that the evidence did not establish a breach of contract, and secondly, on the issue of damages, because we believe that Judge Barrett abused his discretion in determining that there was $1.7 million in damages owed to the first buyer.
Couldn't you just paid $100,000 while this was going on and this would have been over?
Well, that's a great point that you bring up, Your Honor, because the parties contracted for a liquidated damages provision in the contract. So there was a termination fee.
Well, but it required you to notify them that you were rescinding the agreement, and then you pay $100,000, but you didn't do that.
That's a great point. So there's two separate provisions in the right of first refusal, which was incorporated into the contract. There was a termination fee, which was $100,000, and then separately, there was another section that was a liquidated damages provision. So yes, within the due diligence inspection period, if seller terminated the contract, they would have had to pay the termination fee of $100,000. Separately, in the same contract, is a liquidated damages provision that says, for any breach of any term of this contract by the seller, first buyer's sole remedy is $100,000. And Judge Barrett even pointed out in his opinion that the parties estimated $100,000 because they thought that is a reasonable amount of due diligence expenses that first buyer may incur.
But on the why, this strikes me as a pretty egregious breach. To be honest, I read the briefs. It seemed like you gave first buyer a right of first refusal, and as far as I can tell, just intentionally flouted the obligation. You knew that the first buyer had this right, and you were negotiating a second deal, and you never once invoked the right. So, if the right is contingent on, or if any amount of the termination fee, and at least in the right of first refusal, it's contingent on that. It strikes me that you certainly breached the right of first refusal. I suppose you're not disputing that.
No, we are disputing that because there are 2 points to that. One, the contract specifically allowed seller to continue marketing the property to other interested buyers.
But so
we don't believe that negotiating with another party is by itself a breach of the agreement.
That's certainly correct. And then it also said you had to give them a right of first refusal if you adopted the second contract. And that as far as I could tell from reading the opinion, the first time the first buyer learned of it, they thought it was a joke because they were so in the dark on the second contract.
So the language in the right of first refusal says if there's a closing scheduled during the due diligence period, we have to give the right of first refusal. The closing was not scheduled until August. The closing did not occur until August 1st of 2018.
Lulled them into thinking. You said you lulled them. Everything's on go. We're still good.
I mean, we agree that there. Disagree that there was anything intentional about it. I mean, it was, and Judge Barrett even mentioned it at one point during trial that you had two fish on the hook and we're going to see which one would bite, and that's what happened. The second buyer was also out of contract at the time of closing. Their closing was scheduled under the terms of their June 12th contract. They had 45 days to close, and they didn't do that either. So on August 1st, no one was under contract with the right to purchase the property. First buyer's due diligence period had expired.
What is your argument? The way I read this, it says if the seller agrees to sell the property to a third party before the expiration of the inspection period, you shall provide notice of the closing. I read that to mean that once you agreed to sell the property, so the second agreement date is the appropriate date, not the closing date.
Well, and that's a matter of contract interpretation. You're focusing on the word agree, and our position is you focus on the word sell. The sale didn't occur during the inspection period.
If a seller agrees to sell the property, you can agree before you sell. That happens in every real estate case.
Right, and the scenario our client would be in as the seller is the second buyer let their contract lapse. The first buyer never deposited his earnest money, never completed his due diligence, and continued trying to renegotiate the terms of the contract even after
we never notified. I mean, you never notified you didn't notify the first buyer
if he had been
second buyer's offer and the higher price.
Correct. He could have been notified, in which case he could have either matched and paid the $10.4 million or said, no, I'm not going to match that, giving my termination fee of $100,000.
When was the time that he had to match?
That would have been, we don't believe that existed because there was no closing scheduled during his due diligence.
The way I read this is he has to match by the time of closing, and you're suggesting that the closing is the date of the notification duty?
Oh, August 1st was the closing.
Yeah.
You would have had to honor before August 1st.
You're saying that closing, so you basically say that the time that you have to give notice and the time they have to accept is the closing date?
We have to give notice of a closing if it is scheduled to occur within the due diligence period. There was no closing within the due diligence period.
Was it scheduled to close within the due diligence period?
No, because there were so many moving pieces, and the evidence showed that as well, that there were so many moving pieces. Second buyer was already out of contract. There were a bunch of moving pieces, and they...
But I thought you said that it was supposed to close within 45 days with this.
And it didn't. It lapsed. So there was no closing ever scheduled. It wasn't a scenario where you entered into a contract, said, hey, we're going to close on July 30th, and then it just didn't happen. Then I think under that scenario, we would have had to notify first buyer there was a closing scheduled on July 30th. That's within your inspection period. You have to match at the closing table or indicate that you're going to match, or we'll pay you the termination fee. That didn't happen because there was no closing during the inspection period of which we could notify him.
So your damages theory is there's a $100,000 revocation caught. We can revoke the agreement while it's in place for $100,000, or we can mislead you, as Judge Barrett found, and then just pay you $100,000 as part of liquidated damages.
Well,
in other words, like, doesn't matter what we do in between. It's $100,000 or $100,000. We can act as egregiously as we want to while the transaction is potentially going to close, and we still owe you only $100,000 at the end.
I mean, the contract says sole remedy for any breach of any term, and I don't know how the court could find an egregious breach of a contractual term versus a breach.
What did Judge Barrett find?
Judge Barrett, he found that it was a bad faith breach, which the law says a breach of contract claim subsumes any breach of an implied duty of good faith. It was an express term that he alleges was breached. Judge Barrett found that my client breached the right of first refusal, didn't offer the right of first refusal. It's an express term in the contract that was breached. The law says a breach of an express term is a breach of contract. There is no implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in addition to a breach of contract. And Judge Barrett correctly found that there were no additional damages awarded, even though he found that there was a bad faith breach of that contractual term, which was simply not offering the right of first refusal.
Can I go back to, I'm just still trying to understand. So you read the, I'm looking at the contract if you haven't now. If seller agrees to sell the property, do you read that as if seller closes the property?
If seller agrees to sell the property, if the property will be sold.
You read agrees to sell to mean essentially closed.
Yes, if the property will be sold while first buyer is still in their due diligence window.
But why would we read it that way? Because agreements to sell always happen before the actual closing, don't they? Are those tentative agreements, or what you're thinking? Well, that's just how I just understand real estate law, is that you have an agreement and then you say this is the closing date, and then you close on that date, but you have agreed to sell beforehand.
And I understand that point. Seller's sole goal here was to sell this property. We had been in contract with the first buyer in 2017. That contract's lapsed. There was no payment in either direction. He got his earnest money back. There was no penalty, no termination fee. Went our separate ways. The reason all these additional terms and the right of first refusal and termination agreement was added to the 2018 agreement and incorporated into the purchase agreement was to give it some teeth, so both parties had some skin in the game. Because what happened with the second buyer is they went under contract on June 12th, waived the due diligence period, had to close within 45 days, and didn't. So our client would have been left with no buyer, no money, because then you have two potential buyers who are both ignoring their contractual obligations. And first buyer cannot enforce a breach of contract claim when he himself is breached. He did not perform. He anticipatorily repudiated.
Yeah, that's your first argument. I did have one question about that. Are you making a fact? I was unclear if it was what the standard of review was. So it's like he breached, and the question is it a material breach, so substantial performance, are you making an argument that the district court misinterpreted the facts, so it's subject to clear air review, that it wasn't a substantial breach, this putting the money into escrow, or are you making...
No, we believe that the conclusions of law were incorrect and should be reviewed de novo, because I think Judge Barrett, the district court, recited the facts mostly correctly, but then applied them wrong to the law, because...
So it's like a mixed question, because it's whether these facts rise to the level of substantial performance?
Correct. So what Judge Barrett focused on that issue was solely the deposit of earnest money. That is not our argument of the anticipatory breach and repudiation of the contract. It wasn't just the failure to deposit the earnest money prior to it becoming non-refundable, although that was a large part of it because, again, that term, that provision was added in 2018. Can I finish answering the question? That term was added in 2018 for a specific reason, because in 2017, there was no incentive for him to close because he could just walk away and get his earnest money back. So it was not just the refusal by the first buyer to deposit the earnest money before it went non-refundable. It was also him affirmatively representing that he could not possibly close by the August 30th closing date.
You didn't ask him to pay the 150. He doesn't pay the 150. You don't say, pay it. You don't push the issue.
It was identified in a July 18th meeting that he had still not paid it, and then he went and sent an email to his bank that said, hey, I need to pay this money. I mean, he knew prior to the non-refundable deadline that he had not yet deposited the funds. But then additionally, CD3's first buyer's representative testified during trial that he was continuing to try to renegotiate the terms of the contract while he was under contract, saying we're trying to push the closing date out as far as we can. Well, the closing date was in the contract. It was August 30th, and he said, there's no way I can close without these city incentives. There's no way I'll get them until September. There's no way I can close.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Mr. Knecht?
Good afternoon. Your Honors, may it please the Court, Dan Knecht for Appellee Cross Appellant Cincinnati Development 3 LLC, and I'll also refer to Cincinnati Development 3 LLC as first buyer. So I think Your Honor's just heard a lot of requests to on what I think are strained interpretations of an agreement, and also requests to reweigh the evidence from a four-day bench trial on really a scattershot of different issues. I'd like to start with some of the big picture questions so that Your Honors can get a sense of what the district court saw firsthand during the trial. Basically, what happened and why did it proceed this way? The evidence adduced at trial showed that there were actually three breaches by the seller of the purchase agreement for first buyer to buy the Terrace Plaza Hotel. First, as was discussed here and probably the most egregious, the breach of the right of first refusal by failing to give an opportunity to match, even though there was a second agreement as early as June 12th during first buyer's inspection period. Second, that seller violated...
When do you say that they were required to give you notice of... give you your request for first refusal? When does that kick in?
June 12th, or it could be June 13th when they sign the agreement. It's dated June 12th. So on June 13th, they have to give the notice because it's first buyer's obligation to try to match that within the closing time. So I think you could also, you know, had it proceeded this way, and it didn't, but had notice been given, say, the day before it was going to close with second buyer, I think that would also be a breach, and a breach of an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing, because you're basically robbing first buyer of its opportunity to match the second deal.
Why? So switching to damages on that theory, why? The district court's damages analysis essentially said that your damages would be the fair market value of the property, but it looked at case law that didn't have right of first refusal language in it. It seems to me that the breach here was the failure to give you the right of first refusal. So if you think of a world in which the party had performed, the district court also found as a fact that you would never have gone through at the $11 million price. So then it's clear that what kicks in is not the difference between the $11 million and the $9.5, but just the $100,000 termination fee. So under expectation damages, which I understand to be putting the party in the position that the party would have been in if the other side had performed, I don't see how you get more than $100,000 here, because the district court just relied on case law that didn't have right of first refusal language in the contracts.
Yeah, I think there's two answers to that question. One is it doesn't also take into account, well, first, the seller never terminated. So it doesn't limit to only $100,000. As part of that, you know, you have the reliance damages of the special damages here that the court.
Well, that's another question I have. Usually, there's two types of damages in contracts cases: expectation damages, which are tied to if the party had performed, and then reliance damages, which is a separate theory, and it's tied to let's just assume the contract had never been made. And what's put you in the position that you would have been in. And I usually thought that the law was, I actually thought it was pretty black letter law, that you get a right to pick which one of those theories to pursue, but you can't pursue them both.
But that's right, Your Honor. And we chose expectation damages, which also allows for special damages, the award of special damages.
I looked at those cases. I didn't necessarily view those cases as saying you could have what are special damages. These are things I haven't heard of in contracts cases. This looks, the amounts that he gave you the second hand look entirely to me like reliance damages, because it's basically, okay, what was the position you would have been in if you had never engaged in these negotiations? And so it's trying to put you back into without this contract ever having come into existence. So why isn't it reliance damage?
And I think the distinction is if there are special damages that the breaching party would expect you to incur. So it's not just purely, if there's no expectation from the seller that we would incur these, then that might be a different story. But here, it was even baked into the agreement knowing that there'd be due diligence expenses. And when I get back to your prior question is, I never got to the third breach. And that's really where expectation damages come in. As soon as the 60-day inspection period ended, no party terminated, no right of first refusal was offered, the seller's obligation to close at 9.5 is cemented. It's fixed. And so that is the expectation damages, the difference between the 11 and the 9.5. Because as soon as July 30th happens, with no termination and no offer of right of first refusal, they have to close with us at 9.5.
We'll find out, because you didn't pay. I mean, there's at least one thing you had to do, which was pay the $150,000. You didn't do it.
We don't dispute that the $150,000 wasn't paid, but there's nowhere to pay it into, Your Honor. They left that term blank in the contract. We proposed escrow terms. It's odd to have an attorney serve as an escrow agent, and so we sent over on...
What did the district court say about this? Didn't the district court say it was a breach but not a material one? Or?
The question... The district court phrased it as whether or not we substantially performed. And it actually made, you know, two findings on that. One, that the failure to pay earnest money is not a condition precedent, and really the remedy would be 2 months of interest on the...
You didn't say you didn't know where to send the money. That's not what the district court said.
The district court did find that no joint account was ever opened up. So there was no account opened by the seller for us to deposit the earnest money into. It was never done. We ended up...
Okay. I didn't think it said that was the reason why you didn't pay, or you didn't have to pay.
Yeah,
I thought it was just a minor, it was a foot fault, basically, I thought.
I think it's a mix of those. It's It came down to, again, a question of substantial performance, which is a fact-intensive inquiry, and the court found under the circumstances, there being no joint account open, there being incomplete escrow terms.
That's a different question. So it seemed like your closing was effectively contingent on getting this tax deal from the city, and you never got that deal. It appears that you were never going to close without this deal with the city, and to my knowledge, you never got it, even after the additional period of time, even after the July 31 date. You still think you got it after that.
I think that's another, this whole idea of whether they anticipatory or repudiated is another fact-intensive inquiry. There was certainly a request to extend the date. Those requests were always met with, let's talk about it. We always remained under contract.
The request to who, the city or the seller?
To the seller. They were saying,
You're raising the point that you wanted the funding, you wanted to deal with the city, and you didn't have it yet.
Right, but we never terminated.
I know, but they didn't have to say, they just said, they didn't say anything one way or the other.
When you say they, do you mean the city or the seller?
Seller. I thought we were talking about, said to the seller, here's our deal, and they said, let's talk about it, but they didn't.
The seller never said, we're not going to extend, or we treat this as an anticipatory repudiation. In fact, the seller was telling us on July 18th, the first buyer, that we're under contract, and then the seller goes into court on July 30th, the day before the inspection period ends, and says, on an unrelated matter, the property is going to be sold to first buyer. So it was never, no one treated it as a repudiation. Well, it's not uncommon.
From reading the record, it doesn't feel like you were going to buy the property unless you had this deal, and you never got this deal.
There were repeated requests to extend it, but it was never, I'm out if I can't get it. And they were probably, sure that this first buyer would have liked more time to make sure it's cemented, but the question never got called.
Well, but July 30th happened, and you neither got the deal, nor did you pay the $150,000. This is not a case of clean hands on both, one side and
And I'll just say to the contrary, on July 30th, there was still no account to pay the earnest money into. On July 9th, so a couple weeks before then, first buyer's attorney sent over, here, let's finalize these exhibits. Here's the escrow form.
Couldn't you have closed? You couldn't have closed on July 30th? In other words, you weren't going to close because you didn't have this deal.
We had to close within 30 days of the expiration of the inspection period. And so, yes, our commitment, first buyer's commitment, was solidified on July 31st, as was seller's to sell it at 9.5. And again, at that point in time, in the record, there's still no place to pay their money.
Do you dispute that you would have closed in those 30 days?
The question was never called. We were intending to close, and there's testimony in the record that they would have, that first buyer would have done the deal.
Did the finding of fact on this?
Well, Judge Barrett, I think, recounts the testimony from first buyer's principal, Tony Berkla, that he would have done the deal anyways. He says, I don't know if I believe that, but it's speculation because they never offered the right of first refusal. They never gave an opportunity to close. They never called the question.
But doesn't that seem like a pretty significant fact for your theory for why the I had been thinking in my head the right of first refusal was the main breach. And if that's the main breach, then putting you back in the position you would have been in is just giving you that right. The district court made clear that there was a finding that you wouldn't have bought it at 11 or 10.4 million. Therefore, it seems to me that the 100,000 would be for that. But if, because they never gave you the right, and then it's a separate breach at the back end, but there's no finding, it seems to me there has to be some type of finding that you would have gone through on the deal in order to allow for that type of theory to produce damages.
Well, there is certainly evidence in the record that first buyer was going to go through with the deal even at 11 million.
The district court found as a fact on that, and it's not clearly erroneous that you would not have gone through on the deal. You would, if the right had been presented to you, you would not have accepted it.
I think the court is careful to note that the court is speculating, and then the next breath the court says, but we'll never find out because seller never offered the right of first refusal, and when the inspection period closes, both parties' commitments are cemented, and that next day, seller sells to another buyer. So,
I guess it wasn't even clear to me that you were going to do it at 9.5, let alone 11.
And that gets back to this question of the fact-intensive inquiry on repudiation. Nobody believed the agreement had been repudiated. The only evidence in the record is to the contrary from Mr. Galasso, seller's attorney, saying, you know, both to first buyer and then later in a separate hearing that first buyer was moving forward towards a closing. So I think the fact that there may be inquiries about extensions for additional time, that doesn't invalidate the agreement. It doesn't invalidate the commitments. First buyer never terminated. So its commitment was solidified on July 31st to close at 9.5, as was seller's. And I think, one thing I really want to touch on is the argument that there's somehow liquidated damages applicable in this case. There aren't. So on page 19 of seller's third brief, seller argues that it was error for the district court to read sections 3 and 4 of the right of first refusal termination agreement together. I don't know any legal doctrine that requires to read a clause or even a phrase in isolation, and seller certainly doesn't cite any. The district court correctly reviewed the termination fee language. Again, it's not a liquidated damages clause. It says section 3 is termination fee, and it defines the termination fee, and then section 4 discusses its effect. And, these are fact-dependent. Seller only has a limited right to terminate, confined to the 60-day inspection period. And as Your Honors noted, that is limited to giving notice of the termination during the inspection period and then paying $100,000 within 10 days, neither of which happened here. And the argument that that somehow, seller's liability is limited, it actually says upon seller's payment of the termination fee, purchasers shall have no further rights. That never happened. Notice was never given during the inspection period, and seller never paid the $100,000 termination fee. And so there's no language in the right of first refusal agreement that says that the ex post facto or that the seller can try to apply the termination fee ex post facto. And seller drafted it. The seller could have said, no matter what, it's $100,000 whether we terminate or not, whether we pay it or not. And they never included that kind of language in the agreement.
Can I ask you about the special damages? Was that predicated on more than just Berkla's like three sentences where he says we were probably into the 200,000 when the time and energy and through government strategies, through architects and engineers, through all that process of putting together the plans, we were in the several hundred thousand. Is that the predicate for
That's certainly part of it.
What else is there? Yeah.
There, the court noted the expenditures for inspections of drawings, the time spent assembling government strategies and architects, and time spent trying to obtain tax incentives. And all of those activities were supported by documents in the record, like Joint Exhibits 65, 71, and 108 that detailed all the work first buyer did. Plus, there's testimony of not only Mr. Berkla, as Your Honor noted, but Mr. Sullivan and Mr. O'Connell also talking about the work that was done.
Is there testimony on the cost of any of this?
Mr. Berkla supplies the only testimony on the cost. And I think under an abuse of discretion standard, when you've also got the addition, this idea that both parties understand that there's going to be probably at least $100,000 in due diligence expenses in this sort of transaction, that the $200,000 is reasonable in light of all those circumstances.
Well, sometimes, at some point, it gets pretty speculative, right? I mean, this is just stray language in a very
It was certainly unchallenged in any regard by the seller at the time. And again, it's I think when you look at the $100,000 that was contemplated, the testimony of $200,000, and all the documentation detailing the efforts, I don't think it's something that's reversible error.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Terry, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think my colleague, Mr. Connect, hit the nail on the head when he said $100,000 was contemplated. It was contractually contemplated by the parties as a reasonable estimate of first buyer's due diligence costs. There was no evidence introduced to trial to substantiate the $200,000. It is purely speculative, as Judge Murphy inquired about.
Can I ask you about that? I had been thinking of the breach as the breach of the right of first refusal, which seems to me there's a pretty good argument that means expectation damages are what would have happened if you gave the right, and the court found as a fact that the first buyer would not have gone through with the deal, so it would have been the $100,000. But if you view the breach as not closing after the deal had been locked in and the right of first refusal expired, then that might be a basis for what the district court did, which was the, okay, at that point, there was a final agreement for $9.5 million, and so we just had to figure out what the value of the property was at that time. Well, I'm just curious on your answer.
Yes, and that's why we believe that damages order was an abuse of discretion, because the findings of fact seem to make sense. The lower court specifically found that the breach was a breach of the right of first refusal. I mean, that's what the findings state.
That's the point. There's no, your friend on the other side suggested there were three breaches, and there was a finding that there was a breach come the end of the inspection period, and it was locked in, and you didn't perform on the deal.
My review of the lower court's orders say the finding is a breach of the right of first refusal. It's on page, let's see.
Well, yeah, we can look for that, but what were the parties' obligations at that point?
So the parties' obligations, as the court found, that sellers should have given the right of first refusal and breached the terms.
Well, assume that you didn't even have a second contract.
Right.
So say that the inspection period ended, what was it, July 31st or August 1st? Your friend on the other side said then closing should have happened within 30 days of that date. Did anybody have a right to get out of the contract at that point, or was it really locked in?
At that point, it wasn't locked in because the earnest money had not become non-refundable. It hadn't even been deposited yet, although it was deposited by first buyer on August 3rd. So this whole argument that I never could have deposited it doesn't explain why he did it three days late.
Assume we think that's not a breach on their part.
Right, and then the next part is he had affirmatively represented that I cannot do this deal without the city incentives. I cannot get the city incentives until the city planning commission meets in the economic development meets
in
September.
On July 30, or when? When was
that representation? Yeah. That was made, I believe, on July 18th. So there's no indication that the first buyer is ready, willing, and able to close on August 30th.
Yeah, and were there fact findings on that? I don't recall, but
because the lower court focused on the sole breach being the breach of right of first refusal, and under that scenario, the right of first refusal either allows the buyer to purchase it for $10.4 million. Which he's indicated he can't do within that time frame, or get $100,000. And so any damages analysis based upon a breach of the right of first refusal has to look at the $100,000 as being the maximum amount that the first buyer would be entitled to. And again, I'll disagree with my friend at the other table that Section 4 is a separate liquidated damages clause because it specifically says this is the buyer's sole remedy for any breach of any term of this entire contract, not limited to a breach of the right of first refusal. And then finally, just so we can have it on the record here, first buyer has also filed a cross appeal based on the lower court's refusal to find in their favor on the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. I think the evidence in the record is clear and the findings were correct that act does not apply and that the second buyer who purchased it did so at an arm's length transaction for value and that the UFTA does not apply. Does the court have any further questions?
Nothing further. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.